KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
President Trump has proven no one does it better than President Trump.
The Trump administration is celebrating these first 100 days in office. We'll walk through the record on immigration, foreign policy, and the economy.
For a Wednesday, April 30th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, Trump is walking back some auto tariffs for now.
So will car prices still go up? I put the question to the CEO of Ford.
I think it's inconceivable to say that car prices won't go up. Why? 50% of all vehicles bought by Americans are imported.
Also, today is Memorial Day in Israel, a day to remember fallen soldiers.
This year comes as Israelis are deeply divided about continuing the war in Gaza.
Most Israelis understand now that this war that started as a war of necessity has now turned into a war of choice by the government.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The U.S. and Ukraine have signed a deal that will give Washington access to Ukraine's vast mineral deposits and other natural resources. As NPR's Jackie Northam explains, the agreement will help ensure continued U.S. support for Ukraine in its war against Russia.
The deal caps months of negotiations between the U.S. and Ukraine, which at times look very close to falling apart. The agreement is billed as an economic partnership, giving the U.S. a piece of Ukraine's rare earth and other critical minerals. For Kyiv, it's seen as a sign that the U.S. will continue its economic and military support while the war with Russia grinds on. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says the deal signals to Russia that the U.S. is committed to a peace process centered on a sovereign and prosperous Ukraine over the long term. The deal comes just days after President Trump met one-on-one with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky during the funeral of Pope Francis in Rome. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Senate lawmakers failed to pass a resolution today that would have effectively ended President Trump's global tariff policy. Three Republicans joined Democrats, but the effort faced pressure from the White House, as we hear from NPR's Lena Moore.
The failed Senate resolution marked a rare moment of some bipartisan opposition towards Trump, but not enough. Republican Susan Collins was one of the senators who supported it. Before the vote, she told reporters she wanted to send a message.
We really need to be far more discriminatory in imposing these tariffs and not treat allies like Canada the way we treat adversaries like China.
Earlier this month, Collins joined a small group of four Republicans in pushing back against Trump's tariffs on Canadian imports. Despite passing in the Senate, that resolution stalled in the House. Elena Moore, NPR News, the Capitol.
President Trump today acknowledged his tariffs could result in fewer and costlier products in the U.S. However, even amid signs of a weakening economy, Trump doubled down, saying that perhaps, quote, American kids will have $2 instead of 30 as a result of higher prices. A government office designed to unite two agencies appears to have been a casualty of the push to slash federal jobs. NPR's Camila Domonoske says people who work there say after a second round of encouraged resignations, no full-time federal employees remain.
The Joint Office of Energy and Transportation was created by a bipartisan act of Congress in 2021 to focus on EV charging. Gabe Klein was the founding director.
We are mandated by Congress to exist, and that is important for people to understand.
Some of the team's work is being carried on, but at one department or the other, not at the unique joint office. That's according to former staffers who did not want to use their names out of fear of retaliation. The Department of Energy says it's evaluating whether work aligns with President Trump's priorities. The Department of Transportation did not return requests for comment. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
That was up 141 points. This is NPR. Nominations for the 69th Annual Drama Desk Awards, which don't distinguish between work on or off Broadway, were announced today. Since they're given out a week before the Tony Awards, some New York theater insiders think they can sometimes be predictors of Tony winners. Jeff London reports.
The nominators showed love to musicals about robots and cartoon characters. Maybe Happy Ending, the robot love story, received 9 nominations, while Boop, a show about the famous black and white cartoon character come to life, received 11.
Yeah, but now that I've come here, it's where I want to be.
Revivals of Gypsy and Sunset Boulevard got 7 apiece. Two Tony Award favorites, Dead Outlaw and Buena Vista Social Club, didn't make this year's ballots because they were nominated for their off-Broadway runs last year. The former was named Outstanding Musical. The Drama Desk Awards will be presented on June 1st. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The new head of California's troubled high-speed rail project says it is time to get serious about how to actually pay for it. The rail line aims to transport passengers between Los Angeles and San Francisco in under 3 hours. However, the $100 billion-plus project has been delayed for years. New California High-Speed Rail Authority head Ian Chowdhury says he understands the criticisms, but hopes to have a clearer idea by the end of summer as to whether the private sector will get on board to help fund the project. Crude oil futures prices continue to move lower, oil down $2.21 a barrel to $58.21 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
On a Wednesday, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. We're marking President Trump's 100 days in his second term with a series of conversations this week. Trump came to office promising an ambitious agenda to unwind his predecessor's policies and resume where he left off back in 2021.
Now, Trump has broken numerous records in his first 3 months. That includes signing a record number of executive orders and seeing record low numbers of people trying to cross the U.S. southwest border.
He has also imposed the highest tariffs on U.S. consumers since early in the last century, and he has not met promises to quickly end thorny international conflicts like the Russia-Ukraine war.
Okay, we're going to walk through this one by one, and to do that, we are joined by Scott Horsley on the economy, Jimena Bustillo on immigration policy, and Franco Ordonez on foreign policy. Welcome to all three of you.
Hey.
Great to be here.
Good to be with you.
Scott Horsley, you get to kick us off because the economy is once again in the news, and that is because we got a report card from the Commerce Department today. What does it show?
Yeah, not the report card the administration was hoping for. It shows the economy actually shrank during the first 3 months of the year after growing at a fairly healthy pace in the waning months of the Biden administration. Now, a lot of that has to do with anxiety over the president's trade war. You know, we often say presidents get too much credit or blame for what's happening in the giant economy, but Trump's fingerprints are all over this. You know, he has radically changed tariff policy, and we are seeing the effects of that. The stock market, consumer confidence have both fallen sharply on Trump's watch. Now, today's GDP report might exaggerate the weakness in the economy, but Mark Zandi, who's chief economist at Moody's Analytics, says unless the president changes course on tariffs, and fairly quickly, we could be headed for a real economic downturn.
Recessions are a loss of faith. You know, consumers lose faith that they're going to be able to hold on to their job, and they cut back on their spending, and we go into recession.
Now, so far, there's not much sign of people cutting back on spending. We got another report this morning that showed spending grew 0.7% in March. But, you know, that was before the bulk of the president's tariffs actually took effect.
And you said, Scott, there's not much sign of people cutting back on spending yet. Do we know how people are feeling about those tariffs?
We know they're nervous that these tariffs are going to raise prices. And there's also just a lot of uncertainty because over these last 100 days, the president has frequently backtracked. He slapped tariffs on goods from Mexico and Canada, then pulled that back. He ordered taxes on imported electronics, then changed course again. Now he's hinting that his 145% tariffs on Chinese goods might have to be reduced. So if you're a business person or just a shopper, you don't know what the tariff picture is going to be tomorrow or a week from now or 6 months from now. And Kurt Carpenter, who runs a business in Boston selling imported lighting from China, says that's really paralyzing.
For a lot of consumers,
they're taking a wait and see attitude. So we'll definitely be losing business, but we're not losing business to a competitor. We're just losing the opportunity of a sale.
Carpenter says a lot of his products are special ordered, and it's really hard to even give customers a price not knowing what tariffs might be by the time the merchandise makes its way across the ocean.
Scott, we've heard President Trump make the case that these tariffs, they're going to help domestic manufacturers. But what are those manufacturers saying?
Well, some definitely do hope to benefit from these tariffs, but even they're not sure that the import taxes are going to last. I talked to Tom Barr, who runs a business in Michigan that supplies injection molding equipment to automakers, among others. He's really been struggling to compete with mold makers in China, but since the tariffs took effect, he has started hearing from potential customers who might send some business his way.
Within the last week and a half, I've gotten 4 phone calls from people I never heard of, and what they're interested in, they want to reshore all their tooling. That has made our phone ring.
Now, so far, those phone calls have not translated to actual purchase orders, though. These are 6-figure investments, and companies aren't necessarily going to pull the trigger on that if they think the tariffs might be whittled down in the not-too-distant future.
Jimena Bustillo, I'll have you pick it up from here. President Trump ran as a candidate on immigration. He promised to launch mass deportations to shut down the U.S. border with Mexico on day one. So just take stock for us. What has he done in terms of his immigration promises so far?
Immigration has continued to be one of his top priorities. On his first day, he issued 10 executive actions related to immigration, and that ranged from seeking to designate gangs as foreign terrorist organizations to canceling humanitarian parole programs. He's boosted arrest of immigrants suspected of being in the country without legal status, and the administration said that it has arrested about 65,000 people so far. He's also utilized different powers to more quickly arrest people and remove them from the U.S.
And what has the response been to that?
Immigration action spurred dozens of lawsuits across the country. 3 cases have already reached the Supreme Court. And the latest NPR PBS Marist poll shows a slim majority of Americans, about 52%, now disapprove of how he's handling immigration. Of course, that splits along party lines, with Republicans much more in favor.
Now, Jimena, this is Mary Louise jumping back in. Just to note that the administration has kicked off a week of celebrating his first 100 days by talking about border security.
Yes. Here's Border Czar Tom Homan, who spoke to reporters at the White House, really celebrating the efforts.
This is unprecedented success. The border secure. President Trump saving lives. President Trump has proven no one does it better than President Trump.
They're really touting Trump's involvement here. And one data point that they point to is encounters at the southwest border. Those were already trending down when Trump took office, and they've now reached the lowest level in decades. The administration also said its detention centers have reached a max capacity. But the administration has also faced some hurdles in this time, mainly in the courts, as I mentioned earlier. And the onslaught of lawsuits has limited whether and how the administration can remove people from the U.S. Here's Muzaffar Chishti with the Migration Policy Institute.
Unlike any other president, is really testing the limits of the reach of courts in the executive action. And immigration has become the tip of the spear through which that is being tested.
The administration argues that they're complying with various court orders, including from the Supreme Court, but immigrant rights groups challenging the administration say that they're bypassing due process.
So this tension between executive and judicial branches of the U.S. government, obviously very much in play here on immigration and so many other issues. Jimena, quickly, what else are you looking at?
Trump officials also say Congress is moving too slowly to codify Trump's immigration agenda and providing additional funding. The administration wants up to $175 billion to arrest, detain, and remove more people. So I'm watching to see just how much more money Congress ends up giving and to what priorities. If border numbers stay low, the administration needs to focus on enforcement inside the U.S., and that's harder and more expensive.
Franco, I want to turn to you now on foreign policy. When Trump was elected, so many people expected that he would withdraw the U.S. from much of the rest of the world and make sort of a return to isolationist policies of America first. But the version of Trump we're seeing so far, at least, has not been that, right?
No, not at all. I mean, I will say that he has withdrawn from a lot of global institutions, you know, such as the Paris Climate Accord. You know, he's also threatening to undercut NATO and clamp down on Ukraine funding. But he's very engaged. And I'd argue that this is less isolationist and more protectionist. You know, he's been very involved in Gaza, for example, trying to get a new ceasefire deal between Hamas and Israel. He's very involved in the war in Ukraine. Now, he didn't get it, you know, completed in 24 hours or ended, but he is spearheading negotiations to end the war. He's also seeking to basically change the narrative on the war and be more conciliatory to Russia. And Trump's team is now in talks with Iran about stopping its nuclear program. You talked earlier with Scott about tariffs. Trump has basically sought to rewrite the rules of the global economy by launching these tariffs. And those tariffs have disrupted global supply chains, roiled markets, and really undercut confidence in the U.S. economy.
It's so interesting, Franco, because it feels like everybody's trying to figure out, okay, if America first is the mantra, what does that mean? Is it isolationist? Does that mean empire building? It sounds like you're saying protectionist might be the defining feature so far, 100 days in?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you go into kind of like what the defining feature of his administration is, it really is about kind of remaking America's role in the world. I mean, he's radically upended or contributed to the upending of the rules-based system that the U.S. and much of the world has relied on for decades and decades to maintain peace and cooperation since World War II. I mean, it's based on this idea that the U.S. can be safer and stronger if its allies are safer and stronger. Instead, Trump is using American power in ways that are contrary to those established rules, such as threatening to take over Greenland or the Panama Canal. And I actually asked Trump about this and how taking over Greenland, the Panama Canal, actually fits with the America First agenda. Here's what he said.
Because it makes us bigger, stronger, and better, and more protected.
Now, the same goes for the trade wars. You know, Trump is not using, you know, diplomatic tools to reach traditional diplomatic objectives. Some analysts tell me that he's basically trying to carve the world or helping carve the world into spheres of influence. And in the process, actually using the approach of adversaries like Russia, like China, in order to build U.S. power within what Trump sees as the U.S. sphere of influence.
Franco, 100 days behind us, many more to go. Tell us what you're watching.
Well, I mean, I'm going to be watching in the big picture China and how this trade battle pans out. But more immediately, I'll be watching Trump's trip to the Middle East in just 2 weeks. Trump is heading to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. And it is just another example of how Trump is bucking traditions and attempting to, you know, realign the U.S. with other countries. Trump also previously talked about meeting Russian President Vladimir Putin on this trip. He has since downplayed that possibility, but I'll be watching closely to see if anything materializes there.
That is NPR's Franco Ordonez, Jimena Bustillo, and Scott Horsley talking us through the first 100 days of the second Trump administration with a focus on the economy and foreign policy and immigration. Thanks, you three.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Israel marked Memorial Day today, commemorating Israelis killed in wars and attacks. This year's annual remembrance comes as Israelis are reckoning with the war in Gaza. Now more than 18 months long, the longest war Israel has ever waged. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv, and a note, this story mentions suicide.
Memorial Day in Israel began with a piercing siren. Drivers and pedestrians stopped and stood in silence, a unifying moment for Israelis divided about continuing the war in Gaza. This video posted on social media captures a grieving father at the official government memorial service. His son, a soldier, was killed in Gaza. The man screams when the Israeli Speaker of Parliament mentions his son's name. Don't talk about my son, he repeats. You are not worthy of his blood. You don't deserve to be public servants, he says. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu approached the man to console him. At another ceremony, Netanyahu said Israel's young soldiers believe in their mission after the Hamas attack in 2023. Our sons and daughters are not willing to overlook what the monsters did, Netanyahu said. But polls show a little more than half of Israel wants the Gaza war to end and wants a deal with Hamas for the release of the remaining hostages.
Gaza remains a conundrum.
Shira Efron is research director of the nonpartisan Israel Policy Forum.
Most Israelis, we see it in every poll, understand now that this war that started as a war of necessity has now turned into a war of choice by the government.
Since breaking a ceasefire and resuming fighting 6 weeks ago, Israel has been waging a very different war than before, taking over more territory and banning the entry of all food into Gaza, hoping Hamas surrenders. On Memorial Day, Israeli airstrikes killed scores of Palestinians, according to Gaza health officials. They say Israeli strikes have killed more than 52,000 people throughout the war. On a day of official ceremonies, many Israelis chose unofficial ways to grieve. At a fountain in Tel Aviv, every inch is covered in photos, stickers, teddy bears, commemorating young Israelis killed during the war. Shir Laufer was among dozens there. She was remembering her first love, who died by suicide last year on his way to report for duty. She said he had suffered trauma from his years as a combat flight navigator. There's a tendency to think if you're in the skies, you don't see anything, she says, unlike foot soldiers. But she says the decisions you make inside a fighter jet weigh just as heavily. We spoke on Zoom to another Israeli, Gilad Golan, who's visiting Peru to reenact a trip he once took with his son, Sagi. He was killed on day two of the war, battling Hamas militants who had infiltrated Israel. It was days before he was supposed to marry his boyfriend.
Every day that I hear about another fallen soldier, I think about the family, how they get the message, how their lives are broken forever.
Hundreds more Israelis are grieving this year. Israel says it's lost 456 soldiers and civilians since last Memorial Day. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
If you or someone you know is in crisis, please call, text, or chat with the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988.
Today, kids have access to an unprecedented amount of pornography online. Their exposure to explicit content has risen dramatically, and we are not just talking teenagers. Some younger kids are being exposed as well to content that's often violent and degrading. Michaeline Ducleff reports, and a caution, the story includes a description of sexual violence.
For a long time, I thought concerns over children's exposure to pornography didn't apply to me. My child is only 9 years old, and she has had little access to the internet. But Michael Flood says that thinking is naive and mistaken.
We find that parents often really underestimate the extent to which their own children are likely to have seen pornography.
Flood is a social scientist at Queensland University of Technology in Australia. He's an internationally recognized researcher on pornography. He says virtually all children will see porn, either accidentally or intentionally. On average, they first encounter it around age 12, and about 15% see it at age 10 or younger. Flood says many parents are also mistaken about the content of modern pornography.
Often we think of kind of softcore pornography, kind of, you know, Playboy centerfolds, that kind of thing.
But pornography today typically shows something else.
Often shows men being cruel or damaging towards women. And sometimes that's verbal violence, using hostile and derogatory language. Sometimes that's violent behaviors, such as strangulation, such as slapping.
One study from the University of Arkansas found that nearly 90% of popular videos show overt violence or aggression, primarily toward women.
That's not an appropriate form of sexuality education for our 8-year-olds or our 12-year-olds and so on.
Studies have found that exposure to pornography can interfere with children learning about consent. And for younger kids, the videos can be quite upsetting or traumatic, which is why some states are starting to require pornographic sites to check users' ages. Brian Willoughby is a social scientist at Brigham Young University.
It is very important that we provide some very clear gatekeepers that try to prevent some of that exposure.
And there's one very important gatekeeper already in your home. That's your router.
Your router, as a parent, is the most important and underappreciated digital device in your home.
That's Chris McKenna. He's the founder of Protect Young Eyes, a company that helps families, schools, and churches create safer digital spaces. He says it starts by gaining control of your router.
That is the door through which internet traffic comes.
And you can block any website you want from going through that door and reaching devices that use Wi-Fi. It's like putting a bouncer at the door to your internet. In fact, McKenna says you can buy a special router designed specifically to block pornographic content.
It's the number one tool that prevents early childhood exposure to pornography.
Now, this won't stop content on devices that use cellular data, like smartphones. And that's how many kids first encounter pornography, whether it's at a friend's house or even while at school. There are filters and controls for phones, but they're easy to get around, which McKenna says is a big reason not to give a child a smartphone too early.
Delay is the way. That's our mindset, because we've rushed into technologies that our children were not ready for.
The most important recommendation, McKenna says, is teach your kids what to do when they stumble upon any content that makes them feel afraid, shocked, or simply uncomfortable.
Put it down and tell someone.
And be sure they know that no matter what they've seen, you won't be angry, but glad they came to you for guidance. For NPR News, I'm Michaeline Ducleff.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration has been slashing budgets for public health, environmental protection, and education. Big donors and billionaires have stepped up to fill that gap, but most have a different approach.
You've seen lots of foundations either say explicitly or sort of implicitly message that they don't have enough money to do this sort of thing.
Can philanthropy replace public funding? That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, we visit the town of Rising Sun, Maryland.
It was counting on federal grants to help fix flooding, federal grants that are now canceled.
Our sewer plant is going to continue to overflow. We don't have the money to resolve it. This is a no-brainer.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump is acknowledging for the first time that consumer prices could go up, and some Americans might have to do with less as a result of his trade war with China. With more than 100 days in office under his belt, President Trump appears to be backing away from his earlier comments that there would be only short-term disturbances from his trade and tariffs policies. But Trump continues to downplay the impact of tariffs on consumers, including children, this holiday season.
Somebody said, oh, the shelves are going to be open. Well, maybe the children will have $2 instead of $30, you know? And maybe the $2 will cost a couple of bucks more than they would normally.
Trump has been trying to reassure both businesses and consumers that his tariffs won't provoke a recession, but a new government report shows the U.S. economy shrank during the first quarter for the first time in almost 3 years. Here in Los Angeles County, officials approve what lawyers say is the largest legal settlement for sexual assault in U.S. history. This comes after a state law temporarily waived the statute of limitations on cases of childhood sexual abuse. LAist's Jordan Running has more.
The $4 billion settlement stems from a lawsuit filed in 2021, with claims from two women who say they were abused as children in county foster care. The lawsuit grew to include 7,000 people who say they were sexually assaulted as children while at Los Angeles County facilities. Mary Alice Ashbrook is one of the survivors involved in the settlement.
Well, I'm grateful that we were finally heard. This happened to me when I was 8 and 9. I was the kid that just sat under the tree and stayed quiet because I knew the ramifications if I didn't.
Ashbrook, now 65, says she hopes the settlement will lead to reforms to protect children in the county's care. For NPR News, I'm Jordan Running in Pasadena, California.
On Wall Street, stocks finished mixed. This is NPR. The UN Secretary General says he's deeply concerned at rising tensions between India and Pakistan. NPR's Dia Hadid reports.
The spokesperson for the UN Secretary General says Antonio Guterres condemned last week's attack, where gunmen killed 26 people, mostly male Hindu tourists, in Indian-controlled Kashmir. India blames Pakistan for the attack. Pakistan denies any connection. Since then, there's been sporadic gunfire exchanges across the line that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan, and Pakistani officials say they think India will strike in coming days. Guterres also, quote, offered his good services to support de-escalation efforts. The State Department spokesperson also says the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has also reached out to Indian and Pakistani officials and has urged them not to escalate the situation. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
As billionaire Elon Musk considers winding down his advisory job with the Trump administration, a new SpaceX project in Texas is in the works. A vote is scheduled this weekend to turn the South Texas home of SpaceX into an official city known as Starbase. Most of the eligible voters are SpaceX workers, and approval is likely, but critics say the change would give Musk and his company way too much power. Musk has made Austin, Texas his business home for several years now. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Mathnasium, whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com. From Capital One, with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Are Americans about to pay higher prices for cars? That has been a question on the minds of both ordinary folks who buy cars and the folks who make them. Well, now comes news that President Trump will ease tariffs on American automakers to give them more time to relocate production to the U.S. But the tariffs are not going away, and there are still a lot of questions about what impact they will have. Questions we are going to put now to the CEO of Ford, Jim Farley. He's on the line from Ford's Kentucky truck plant. Welcome, Mr. Farley. This is Louisville, where you're speaking with us from.
You got it. This is our biggest, most important truck plant in the world for Ford.
Okay. Well, I want to ask you more about the plant in a second, but let's just go straight to the news of President Trump saying he will walk back some tariffs. You put out a statement welcoming the move. Just briefly explain why.
Well, Ford is the most American company. We make 88% of what we sell in the U.S. here. And so the tariffs for us are a bit different than the industry. The U.S. industry is about 17 million units. And 8 million of that, about half, are imported through ports around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And half is built in the U.S. So the tariffs will have a really big impact on our industry because 25% cost increase for 50% of the vehicles sold in America.
So you're saying Ford already makes 80% of your cars in the U.S. That's more than any other U.S. automaker. I want to ask about the parts, though. Because a lot of the parts you use to build those cars do come from other countries, Mexico and so on. Will you be shifting to U.S.-based suppliers?
Well, on average, our localization of the parts, as you said, is around 75%. That's either USMCA-compliant parts coming from Mexico or Canada. During Trump 1, we negotiated a USMCA, where even a part made in Mexico could have a lot of U.S. content in it. So the 75% I mentioned is visualized in F-150. 75% of the parts either come from the U.S., about half, and the rest are coming from those other countries, but they have a lot of U.S. content as part of that.
But I guess the central question here, if the administration's stated goal with easing these tariffs for now is to give automakers like you time to shift production, how do you decide whether or not to do so when the tariffs themselves are a moving target, when President Trump may change his mind again in 2 days?
So what the Trump administration did yesterday, to make it simple, is they gave all the automakers, Ford's in a different spot, as I said, about a 15% leeway on parts that are non-USMCA or non-US. So they're giving us kind of an exemption for carpets, washers, fasteners, wiring looms, stuff that honestly we can't even get in the U.S. And also stuff that, frankly, if we made here, it would make the car a couple thousand dollars more expensive, which is too expensive for what we think. So
does that stuff stay overseas? You'll continue getting that from overseas?
No, I mean, we'll continue to do the math and aggressively move localization. But the one thing we have to balance is affordability. The F-150 is $800 a month already and is America's best-selling vehicle. Do we want to make that $850 a month? You know, and that's the balance between affordability and making 100% of the parts here or, you know, keeping it as is.
I nodded to the big question on a lot of ordinary Americans' minds. Are the prices of our cars about to go up? Will prices still have to go up even with this at least for now, scaling back of some of the tariffs?
I think it's inconceivable to say that car prices won't go up. Why? 50% of all vehicles bought by Americans are imported, and those imported cars will get a 25% tariff now. That is literally $5,000 to $10,000 a vehicle. So for the importers, and actually some of those companies are local companies, you know, some of our competitors that are domiciled in the U.S., and they have big decisions to make, because their tariff bill will be very large compared to Ford.
And how about it for you at Ford?
We only import about 10%, something like that. And so for us, we have 6 to 10% margins, 25% tariff on the parts that we don't build in here, like 20% of our vehicles, you know, is billions. But we can offset that, and it depends how our competitors act. Will the overseas importers, you know, increase prices and allow us to gain market share and therefore, you know, build even more here and be able to more than offset that in terms of the pricing we would have to take? I don't know. It will all come down to this summer when those increased prices may or may not happen, and for deciding what do we do about that competitive dynamic.
So I'm trying to pin you down on this. It's, if the basic question is, are Ford prices going to go up? It sounds like the answer is, we don't quite know yet because there's so much uncertainty in your industry.
I would say that's the right answer. You know, we announced today, actually, I can announce it right now, that we're extending employee pricing through July 4th. We want to enter this period of uncertainty by reassuring Americans, if you buy a Ford, you don't have to worry about that, at least through July 4th.
And I mean, I can hear the factory floor and the supply line behind you. Just paint me a picture of a year from now, how different things might look. Because I'm wondering, you know, if you're looking at, for example, jobs, another stated goal of these tariffs is to provide jobs for American workers. Won't a lot of the work, say, at the Kentucky plant where you were speaking with us from already be automated, be robots, be AI?
A year from now, I don't know what's going to happen, but I will know what's happening at Ford. We're building two brand new plants for expand our hybrid and electric lineup. I think that Ford, because of the tariffs, we're the best position. For many years, we built 80% in the U.S., and we had much higher costs than our competitors importing overseas. Well, that will start to change now. And I believe in Ford's case, this is a pretty big opportunity for us.
Last thing, Mr. Farley. I know that you have spoken directly to the president about these tariffs. What did you learn from those conversations?
Well, what I learned is that I think he is very committed to building more jobs like these in America. I mean, these are the best of the best, you know, hourly jobs you can find in America. He's very committed to that. But I think, you know, the issue that we all have to work through together is how fast can that change and what will be the pricing and the affordability that we can manage through that transition.
Would more predictability be useful for your business?
Well, sure, cost increases are not great for any industrial company. On the other hand, we have committed to the U.S. We want to expand jobs in the U.S. And so it's a balancing act between affordability and these great jobs. And I think I would just say there's no quick answer here. This is a long-term policy change, and we have to work together through it, even the most American companies like Ford.
Jim Farley is president and CEO of Ford, joining us there from the Ford Kentucky truck plant in Louisville. Jim Farley, thank you.
Thank you.
And a point of clarification, Jim Farley said about half of the F-150's parts come from the U.S. According to Ford, it's actually closer to 60%.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Generations of Black workers found a path into the middle class through federal government jobs. The Trump administration's job cuts are now throwing that sense of stability up in the air for many Black families. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong met with one of them.
Shirley Hopkins built careers for countless other Black workers.
This is one of the awards that I got.
And she has the plaques from the federal government to prove it.
I was puffed up.
And it was for promoting equal opportunity?
Equal opportunity.
Before she retired from the National Institutes of Health, she was known as the recruitment lady. She made it her mission to encourage more Black students in the Washington, D.C. area to apply for the agency's internship and youth employment programs.
It was equal opportunity for those who really didn't have. You were able to get them a chance to get into the federal government.
Hopkins first got into NIH back in the 1960s as a nurse's aide in clinical trials. The federal job came with benefits her parents didn't have.
Vacation, you're covered. Sick leave, you're covered. and not being fearful like you are now, whether or not you're going to lose your job.
These days, the Trump administration's slashing of government jobs and attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs are upending a path into the middle class for many black workers. It began when World War II brought a boom in government jobs.
Black Americans, for the first time, had doors open to them that really weren't open before.
Frederick Gooding Jr. is a historian at Texas Christian University who wrote a book about black federal workers called American Dream Deferred.
It was very difficult for black Americans to find any type of well-paying job, particularly outside of agricultural or domestic endeavors.
But by the 1940s, Gooding says the federal government's merit system offered opportunities that helped a black middle class grow.
Now, the flip side to this is that a good government job was not necessarily a golden ticket.
The federal civil service has had long-standing racial and ethnic pay gaps. Gooding says he's concerned the push by Trump officials to dismantle DEI programs will leave black federal employees in a very vulnerable position when it comes to workplace discrimination. The White House did not respond to NPR's request for comment.
They say cut back!
We say fight back!
Some federal employees are trying to organize, including at the U.S. Postal Service, where, like at many other federal agencies, black people make up about a third of the workforce, while their share of the country's population is around 15%.
Our family is under attack, and we're going to fight like hell to make sure that they get their hands off the Postal Service and hands off the Department of Education.
Kevin Abernathy helped lead this rally outside D.C. He's a nephew of Shirley Hopkins, who pushed him to apply for his first federal job as a teenager. Now he's a union steward with the National Association of Letter Carriers.
Not too bad. I'll put the day's mail in there.
After more than three decades with USPS, Abernathy delivers on what he calls a retirement route in Maryland.
I love serving the people. Post office has given me everything I have in life, the cars, my home. I raised four kids on this salary.
Until recently, Abernathy's career advice to his kids was consistent.
If they didn't make millions of dollars catching a football or shooting a basketball or whatever, the government is where you want to be.
But his oldest son has decided it's no longer where he wants to be. With the Trump administration pushing to shrink the federal workforce, Abernathy's son left a government job in January to join the private sector. You went into government for stability. Your oldest son left the government for stability.
Yep, different times. Things are changing. We just don't know what the outcome is going to be.
And that means adjusting career advice for his youngest children. He's advising them to look outside the government for now. Anzi Luong, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Trump administration canceled billions of dollars of grants that were supposed to help the country prepare for weather disasters. Towns, cities, and tribes were counting on that money to protect residents from floods, wildfires, hurricanes. It's a particularly tough situation for small rural towns that do not have any other way to pay for such projects. NPR's Rebecca Hersher visited one such town.
The Sun Valley Mobile Home Park in Rising Sun, Maryland, is at the bottom of a hill.
So here's the trailer park right here, and you can see...
Calvin Bonnenberger is the town administrator.
This is all low-income housing, and the flood level is up to the roof line of all of these properties. And so remember what I was telling you...
This area has flooded over and over. In 2021, the flooding was so dangerous that people had to be rescued from their homes.
We're talking about water that was about this high.
Like three feet. The low-lying trailers aren't a safe place to live anymore. The town has a plan. Help the remaining residents move to higher ground and turn the damaged area into a park. But fixing flooding problems in Rising Sun is expensive. It's not just the trailer park. The town's wastewater treatment plant also floods when it rains a lot and sends contaminated water into nearby streams. Fixing both problems would cost millions of dollars that Rising Sun just doesn't have. The town has fewer than 3,000 residents. It only collects about $1 million in taxes every year, says Bonnenberger.
You know, not everybody's wealthy.
And so Rising Sun applied for federal grants, which took years of work, not only to get the application materials together, but also for Bonnenberger and other town leaders to make the case to local residents, many of whom don't support federal involvement in local projects. This area voted overwhelmingly for President Trump.
I think it's safe to say that the people in this area, you know, they are conservative, and they do believe that there's too much government waste going on.
Bonnenberger generally agrees with that. But in this case, asking for federal money made a lot of sense to him. The funds the town applied for were offered by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. And they were for this exact purpose. FEMA's idea was to invest money before weather disasters to prevent even more expensive damage later. Studies have estimated that you spend $1 now to prepare, it saves about $7 later by preventing damage. And as the earth warms up, extreme weather, like the heavy rain that causes flooding in Rising Sun, is only getting more common.
Our sewer plant is going to continue to overflow, and there has to be money to resolve it. We don't have the money to resolve it. That's what this money is for. This is a no-brainer.
Last year, Rising Sun won two grants, one to fix the sewer plant and another to fix the trailer park. It was a total of about $5 million. Which was good news for people like Margaret Dunn. She lives across the street from the Sun Valley Mobile Home Park. On a Wednesday afternoon, she was outside playing with her 2-year-old grandson and her son, Aaron. She says the floods have taken a toll on the area.
We had a neighborhood with kids that played, and you know what I mean? There was activity,
yeah.
Neighbors watched out for each other and stuff.
Yeah.
That stuff is gone.
She points out that a lot of the trailers are still damaged. Warped coat hangers and waterlogged books sit on the porch of one. Another has insulation drooping from a giant hole in the siding. A lot of people have moved away. Some have stayed. The town was going to use the FEMA money to remove all the debris and turn the area that floods into a park instead. But now that money is gone. The Trump administration canceled the entire program. In a statement announcing the decision, FEMA called the grants, quote, wasteful and ineffective. I asked Bonnenberger what he thinks of that characterization. In their eyes, this program was waste.
Right. I think I feel very strongly, and I think my personal belief is shared by a lot of people in this area. We all sort of suspected that probably our taxpaying money was not being used the way we would like it to be used. So with all this being said, I'm not looking to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
The baby, in this case, being the money for his town. He thinks FEMA was wrong to cancel Rising Sun's grants, but he still supports the larger effort to cut wasteful spending. The administration just needs to use a scalpel, he says, not a dull knife. At the same time, he's frustrated, and he's concerned about the safety of his residents every time it rains. If he had a chance to make his case to the administration, here's what he'd say.
Guys, this is dangerous. This is the whole reason why you put this funding out there.
FEMA did not respond to questions from NPR about why it deemed the grants wasteful or about the administration's larger approach to disaster preparedness. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
A movie star has just set an all-time record on the Billboard pop charts. NPR's Stephen Thompson has the report.
The actor Jack Black is also a veteran singer. He's even hit the Billboard charts with his band Tenacious D. But he's far better known for his work in movies, especially popular kids' films like Kung Fu Panda, the Super Mario Brothers movie, and now a Minecraft movie. This week, his life as a singer and his life as an actor have dovetailed as Jack Black has just set an all-time record on the Billboard Hot 100. He has recorded the shortest song ever to hit the chart.
La 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 lava, chicken. Steve's lava chicken, yes.
That's Steve's Lava Chicken, which Jack Black co-wrote with a Minecraft movie's director, Jared Hess. It enters this week's Billboard Singles chart at number 78. We only had time to play an excerpt, we're very busy, but the complete song runs all of 34 seconds. Fortunately for those with more patience than that, there's an official remix that stretches Steve's Lava Chicken to nearly a minute and a half.
Welcome to the stash. Steve's Lava Chicken.
The previous record for shortest song in the history of the pop charts belonged to the rapper Kid Cudi. In 2020, his 37-second instrumental song Beautiful Trip peaked on the Hot 100 at number 100. Now, this isn't the first time Jack Black has hit the charts with a song from a kid's film. 2 years ago, while playing Bowser in the Super Mario Brothers movie, he charted with a song of forbidden love and desire called Peaches.
Peaches, 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 peaches.
Peaches became a viral hit as it peaked at number 56. It also picked up a fair bit of Oscar buzz, though it failed to make the cut for a Best Original Song nomination. Still, Jack Black shouldn't lose all hope for the award's future of Steve's Lava Chicken. After all, that 34-second song has just hit the charts, and there's no rule that says it's too short to win an Oscar. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
La 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 lava, chicken. Steve's lava chicken, yes, tasty as hell. Ooh, mama, see, now you're ringing the bell.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves...